is dyslexic design thinking. For the past 25 years, Gil Gershoni has been the head of his own branding agency, Gershoni Creative. And one of the things he's passionate about rebranding is his dyslexia. In this series, Gil sits down with members of the dyslexic community for eye-opening conversations about the intersection of dyslexia and creativity, and what dyslexia can teach us about ourselves and the world around us. Today, Gil talks to Chris Arnold, an innovator, strategist, writer, and entrepreneur whose work builds connections between brands, communities, and diverse minds. Enjoy.
Today's episode is part two of a two-part series featuring Chris Arnold, an innovator, creative thinker, writer, and entrepreneur. Chris, thanks again for taking the time to sit down with us today. It's always a pleasure to chat with you. Let's talk a bit about your childhood before you were diagnosed. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I have no problem talking about this, I have to say. I was at an event recently and we were teaching in schools, and I love schools because this is a chance where we are. I can talk about schools a bit later about what we're doing in them, and it's really amazing. But we were asked that question, so I did mine, and one of the other chaps who was autistic was asked a question, and he just kind of went pale and said, I don't want to talk about my childhood, you know. Mm. I was, there were three of us, my two brothers, and my older brother was a bit of a genius in academic terms, but he's quite linear. But he was certainly a genius in that day, high IQ. My twin brother was kind of in between the two, and although we all had, I think, fairly high IQs, I was the black sheep of the family. So very early on, I didn't read very well. I didn't write very well. I was more chaotic. I did things in different ways. I was always having to do things in a different way. And my parents would always say that horrible phrase that can take you down, which is, what's wrong with you? You know, I think a lot of us relate to that term. You know, why do you have to be different? And it was never said in a positive way. And when I was in primary school, which is, for those who are not familiar with the English system, that's really from about 5 up to about 10. And I've got a 6-year-old who's in primary school at the moment. I was getting treated very badly. And, you know, at the very beginning, you know, nobody can read and write. But then as it went on, I was obviously a laggard. And I got held down a year at school for not reading and writing. And what was interesting, I sat in a conversation and the teacher was saying to my mother, well, I don't know what's wrong with him. I don't think he tries hard enough. You know, and you go, trust me, I try. Yeah. You know, I said, what really puzzled me, he's very creative. He seems a very good problem solver. But academically, he's just completely failing. And there was this emphasis to say that somehow I was deliberately doing it. And I had no idea really why. I didn't understand. But I did know I was good at certain things. And I remember one day, it was probably the top end of the primary school, and the headmaster walked in and said, Arnold, come over here. He said, I believe you're the most creative person in the school. And for that moment, you glow, don't you? He said, wow, I've been recognized for something at last. He said, I have a job for you. And I thought, great. And all the kids are looking at me, for once jealous. I go out of the classroom, takes me to the playground, gives me a white coat and says, here's a can of paint. I want you to repaint the hopscotch lines. And it was like, really? Come on. So I found what I found there as I went into the secondary school area when I transferred. I went to public school when I was 12, or private school, as I also know, fee paying. And it was a good school. And it was a lot better because instead of trying to, what you find with a lot of the government schools, they try to level you all down into the middle. Private schools do tend to try and bring out your talent. And I found that what I excelled at very well was stuff that was about innovation. So creative, anything creative, I was very, very good at. And I got involved with various things. So I could channel my ability down those and not worry too much about the academic. Although ironically, I was actually very good at maths, which is not uncommon with dyslexics. And I went through the creative field. And I then, when I got to 16 and I sat on my exams and failed all the ones to do with writing and reading, and I had to resit them twice and got them in the end, went to another school in London, because we moved to London by this time. And again, I channeled myself into creativity and then decided that the only place to go after that was art college. So I went to a place called Hornsey College of Art, which is a very famous art college, and then went on to study Kingston University. And it was, for me, it was like suddenly I didn't have to worry about the academia anymore. You know, I could just get on with doing what I could do. And that's why so many dyslexics end up in the creative fields. It's because, A, we have a creative ability, but there's no academia. And when I'm actually hiring young people, I don't care about their CVs, I don't care about their academia. I only want to know what the talent is. So, of course, not surprisingly, you know, the creative industries is a good place. But most of my childhood was fairly rough in that sense of trying to either find a solution around a problem and being very strategic, or trying to cover it up. And I think a lot of them can relate to that. You know, you're trying to make sure people don't notice you can't do things. So, for example, when you're asked to read out loud, because often in classes I'll say, here's the book everyone's got to read. And I'll be like, I don't even know where we are. And then they say, right, Chris, it's your turn. Can you read out the next paragraph? And I would suddenly have a cough and a choke and make some horrible excuse. And then the teacher would lose patience and go, Brian, you read it. You know. And other simple things you realize about, you know, sort of structural things that you don't get right. So, yeah, I think it was always that balance between losing your confidence and feeling like you're crap and you're no bloody good and, you know, you should just give up, to then fighting back and going, no, I have got some ability and I am going to be good at this, and finding little moments of wins. I don't think my parents were very supportive. I mean, I think I was criticized most of the time because I had this genius brother who got full marks, went to Cambridge, got a top degree and everything.
Mm-hmm. So where did you find encouragement? Where did that come from in those days?
I had a fantastic teacher who did say to me that you being different isn't a bad thing. He said the world needs different people. And I remember that very early on when I was about probably 10. And he understood that we aren't all the same. And he said, look, you know, we may all look the same. He said, but we're not, are we? And yeah, this idea, you start the same, we all look the same. We go, yes. But he said, well, no, we're not. You know, we've got different heights, different body shapes, we've got different hair, different eye colors. We all behave the same differently. You know, some people are very energetic, some people aren't. Some people are good at sports, some aren't. And he said, you know, that's the same about how we think. You just think differently from everyone else. See it as a positive difference, not as a negative difference. You know, the world needs people who think and are different. And I think that kind of was a thread that kept me going pretty much through the rest of my life. Was the fact that there is a role for us who think differently, and it's a positive thing. And it's actually now being more positive than it ever was. You know, people are now seeing it as a talent. You know, we are now seen as super thinkers.
Yeah. I find that having that encouragement earlier on, if it's family, if it's a teacher, if it's somebody in your community, it really makes a massive amount of difference, because all you want to be is seen for who you are, as different as you are, and be appreciated. And if somebody else sees you, then you can see yourself. And then you can, as you said earlier, you know, kind of build your confidence, you know.
Well, actually, I want to just go to schools for a moment, because I do quite a lot of work in schools now. And I work with a couple of SENCO teachers who are the people who teach special needs. Now, the thing that we had a very interesting conversation is, you know, when you get identified in a school as being dyslexic, the first title they give you is special needs. Well, that would be nice if it was a positive way, but it's never put as a positive way. It's put as a negative way. You're broken. You need fixing. You then get, if you identified as ADHD, what does ADHD mean? Attention deficit hyperactive disorder. Hang on a sec. You know, that's a bit like saying to someone, you have a running disorder because you run too fast. You know, or you have a beauty deficit because you're too pretty. Why is it we put badges on kids? Yeah, you know, what does a 9-year-old think when they turn around and say, oh, you're ADHD? What does that mean? Oh, you have a deficit disorder. Oh, Christ, I'm wrong. I'm broken. And kids are very conscious of that idea that they can feel broken. You know, they're all trying to be confident. And the whole system seems to start by whacking you down and kicking you down. And SENCO teachers will tell you, so, you know, it's not that, you know, they have a learning difficulty. We have a teaching difficulty. That's the reality. We don't teach kids the right way. We teach kids all in the same way. And who created that style? It was a bunch of people in Neurolinear. There's a great guy called Dr. Sir Ken Robinson, who's sadly passed. But if you've not come across him, check him out. He was a great speaker about education. He wrote a big report about education, said it was stuck in the Victorian period. It was stuck in producing people not fit for purpose for today. We are not training people for the future work. And I go into schools, and what we do when we go to schools, we start by saying, how many of you are dyslexic? And we'll get maybe out of 300, 10 hands go up. Then we talk about the future work. We say, okay, if you look at, for example, the EY, World Economic Forum document, it predicts that 50% of jobs will vanish, almost all neurolinear-based jobs that can be replaced by AI, technologies, software, robotics. Basically, anything's really straight. We can make machines that can do that job and better. The ones that can't be replaced are those that require higher cognitive thinking. So anything that requires higher cognitive thinking requires people who think differently. We can either train people to do that, maybe, or we can tap into the fact that up to 15% of people do that already, which are largely dyslexics. So I don't talk about this. I talk about the fact that they're going to probably be doing jobs that have not yet been invented in companies that will probably be massive but have yet not been invented. I mean, look at Zoom, for example. Zoom's 11 years old, has over 7,000 employees. It's worth $25 billion, you know, and it didn't exist 11 years, 1 month ago. So you know, we picture this future, we talk about this future, and we say, you know, this is why they're going to need high-end thinkers. And we say, you know, they're going to need super thinkers. These super thinkers are going to be drawn from especially dyslexic. So over a period of half an hour, we reproduce, we take the word dyslexia, and by half an hour later, we've now turned it into a superpower, super thinker, super ability. And we say, these people don't tend to fit in the current education system. Or, did I ask a question, how many people in the audience are dyslexic? Suddenly, there's 50 people with their hands up.
Oh, wow.
You know, because they're now being recognized as something that has a talent. I said, stand up, guys. You are the super thinkers of the future. You're the guys who've got the talent that they're going to want when you leave school. You know, and don't suppress that talent. Embrace that talent. And I get the same feedback from parents all the time saying, wow, that has so inspired my child. Just, I know from my days, somebody coming in and saying that to you could be all it takes to turn that kid into a success. You know, and I hope that maybe, you know, out of, you know, hundreds of kids I talk to, if just a couple of them, it's changed their life, because not everybody gets support at home. It makes a difference, then great. Because I wasn't getting any support at home, but that one teacher changed how I thought.
Yeah, and I'm sure for those 50% that did recognize that it was a gift, that was probably a pivotal moment for the rest of their life, that they're going to realize that that's the moment that I realized dyslexia is a positivity. When was that transformation for you as a child? When did you realize that dyslexia was not a negative, but a positive?
I think it was interesting that there were things that I had to say, this super genius brother, and genius in the context of what academia sees as genius. You know, he got a first in everything at school. He went to Cambridge and got a first, and, you know, and was a super, you know, amazing character. But there are things he couldn't do that I could. I could beat him at certain puzzles and quizzes and games. And I realized that I was a strategic thinker and he wasn't. You know, I could beat him at chess because I can outthink him strategically. So there's a great moment of going, you know, my big brother is great, but hang on, I just beat him. You know, so I think there was a certain amount of that. And I think also I found I was very good at, you know, getting out of holes, you know, getting out of problems. And I think we become slightly strategic thinkers, not just because it's natural, but because we're often having faced with situations where at school, you're having to say, oh my God, how am I going to get out of that? Or how am I going to make up for that? How am I going to solve this problem? The one I never solved was learning languages. And, you know, some dyslexics are good at languages, some aren't. And whether this is a dyslexic thing, I don't know. But I am diabolical at languages. My wife is Spanish and I can speak all of 16 words of Spanish. My six-year-old son can speak more Spanish than me. I just cannot learn languages, yet my father could speak six languages fluently. So I never found a strategy for doing that. It just doesn't work for me. But I found strategies to get around a lot of things.
Yeah. Well, I can, you know, sometimes the contrast gives you sort of the insight that, and also my brother is quite talented in different ways than I am. And I was always working 10 times as hard and getting half the marks. But then I realized that he's very, very smart in, you know, the books and the sort of memorization and that kind of knowledge. But thinking in more abstract ways is definitely not a skill he has. And, you know, and that contrast to see, okay, I can remember, I can't get the high scores, but I can definitely solve things in a massively creative ways. Definitely give that contrast as well. And, you know, I don't know about language. I was born in Israel and I speak Hebrew, but I only learned English because I was forced to, you know, I mean, so it was really more of a necessity than a talent.
I don't know if you have the same in America, but we have the streaming system in Britain. So you have the A, B, C, C streaming. And of course, my older brother was in the A stream and I was using the C stream. And instantly that puts people into a kind of category that says, you're going to be successful and you're not. Or you're going to work at McDonald's and you're going to, you know, become an management consultant. And I have a real problem with that. I believe, as I said earlier, what we created in the company was a flat structure. We didn't put a kind of hierarchy in. We didn't want anyone to think that you're better than each other. We wanted people to think that you are good at what you're doing personally, and that was all has a value, you know. And there is no competition here. And I think the school does create a competitive mindset, but I think schools don't look at kids. And this is the really key thing, because for anybody who's neurodiverse, especially talking about dyslexia, what happens before 7 years old is what impacts on the life. Mm-hmm. You know, it's those younger years which makes a difference. You make or destroy the person within those first years, those early years. You know, what happens by the time they get to 25 is different. I think, however, the thing that was a pivotal moment in my life was I left art college, got a job in advertising, and was doing okay at it, actually, and found that this was something that fitted my mindset very well. It's strategic, it was creative, it was interesting, and it was fast-moving, and we're doing something different every day, which, of course, one likes. And we'd picked up a small client who a charity called the Dyslexia Institute. Now, I didn't really know about dyslexia at this stage. I certainly knew what problems I had or challenges I had. my differences. And I went to the meeting to get the brief. And I'm sitting there, and this guy called Harry Chastey, who was the head of the organization, was leaning over my shoulder, looking at me, writing stuff down. He goes, "You didn't tell us you're dyslexic." I went, "What? Am I?" He goes, "Yeah, let me do it." So he tested me, and that's when I was formally tested. And I've heard this from so many people. It was a bit like someone took a hood off my head. It was like, oh, there's now a reason. I understand why. I understand. And because, whether that's good or bad, by just understanding and having a kind of almost a positive badge, rather than a negative one, it made you think, wow, this is like explains everything. But it also said, I therefore don't feel bad about things I can't do. You know, because there was this context of saying, well, this is why you're good at this. It's like the psychometric profile. I'm good at this because I'm not good at that. That's fine. Other people are the opposite. And so I found it was absolute eye-opener. And that point was when I said, guys, I'm dyslexic. I'm going to tell the world. And I did. And we did this ad for the Sex Institute, which ended up winning loads of awards for us. And we, in fact, won loads of awards for their campaigns. And my copywriter at the time, because I was the art director, although I ended up writing quite a lot of headlines, was not at all dyslexic. And he was a bit sort of like, do you really want to talk about this? I said, no. And so we had a big feature about this ad we did, which showed a pen that was a snake. And it came from interviewing a young kid who said, you know, when I pick up a pen, it's like picking up a snake. It's scary. And we did the pen. It said, I can't remember the headline now. It was not. But it really highlighted the aspect of the fear of kids when it comes to reading and writing. And when we did the interview in Creative Review, I went very public about being dyslexic. And then what was interesting was I got all these phone calls from people saying, I'm dyslexic. Nobody was talking about it. And we ended up making a cinema commercial with a guy called Charlie Paul, who was dyslexic. And he'd just won loads of awards for animation. And it was great. And we got together with him. And then we found this production company who did sound. And the guy there was dyslexic. And then we said he made all the sound for it. We had all the animation for it. We got a voiceover who was dyslexic. And then we found a guy who ran a cinema chain who was dyslexic. And suddenly all this dyslexic came together and this commercial ran. It won loads of awards. But it made a real difference. It really did. And it was start of a campaign that was very significant in my life. And people would say, what would you put on your epitaph as five greatest things you've ever done? And at the time, education treated dyslexia. It was D for dyslexia, D is also for dunce. So we were seen as stupid. We were seen as idiots. We were, oh, parents are just making excuses for not teaching their kids to read. And there was a very negative attitude towards the word. And of course, the original word is all about mixing up letters and not reading and writing. It's much broader these days. And what we did working with the Dyslexia Institute was we changed and flipped that around. And we did a strategy of trying to say, let's find a way of making every teacher take more responsibility instead of just pushing it aside. And by weird coincidence, it's something, you know, typical of what we dyslexics do. We connect the dots. I'd read a figure about what the estimated number of dyslexics were in the school, which, by the way, is a lot lower than we say now, and the number of classrooms. And they were exactly the same. I thought, hang on a sec, that means there is one child in every classroom who must be dyslexic according to these stats. And that became the strategy. And what we did by saying there's one child in every classroom who's dyslexic, and if you're ignoring it, you are being irresponsible. And we flipped the whole education debate around. And within a year or two, suddenly everyone was now taking a positive attitude, recognizing it. They felt the need to recognize it. So we changed the political goalposts. And then the Institute became very involved in advising the government on policies and stuff. But it was kind of a pivotal moment that came out of that. And it really changed how people thought that suddenly, yeah, what do you mean you've got no children in your class who are dyslexic? Of course there's one. Why have you not spotted them? Why are you not doing anything about it? It changed the balance. And I think that was a real big move on. Now we reckon there's four or five, you know, so yeah. It's changed a lot. But the terms come a lot broader as well.
That's right. And I mean, there's many different kinds of dyslexic and we're all different like everybody else. I want to move to our professional lives. You know, you and I are both kind of living in intersections of brands and the world around, connecting to the world around them. Tell me a little bit about Connect2.
Well, Connect2 is originally formed out of a spin-off of one of my specialities in the ad industry has been ethics. I was probably one of the first people to really champion it. When I was at Saatchi's, it was one of the areas I came very conscious of. I met a woman who had come to work there. And this is in the very early days of CSR. And she and I just bonded. And it kind of was an eye-opener because she taught me a lot about, you know, CSR and all these things. And back in about 2000, that wasn't really a conversation anybody was having. And it was something that was very far over to the right. And I went back to the board. I said, look, we should be championing ethics far more. And we'd actually had a briefer over my desk, which is selling cosmetics to African women, which would have cost them pretty much a month of their money. And it was exploiting their heritage with war paint, basically. It was disgusting. Absolutely was wrong about it. We had a client called Sunny D who wanted to relaunch. I just said, look, we've got to stop doing this. This is not right. It's wrong. This is not what the consumer wants to see. And I think they found me a bit of an oddball because I was championing this idea of ethics. And someone said to me, look, why don't you go and set up your own agency? So actually I did. I left Sarches and I've been working there with a great team of people. There's Dave Droga there, who's now sort of very high up in the list. And some other great creatives. I took the leap and I started up Feel, which is probably the first boutique creative ethical agency in UK. And it was a bit of a struggle because we were way ahead of the curve, like so way ahead of the curve. But out of that, I was doing a lot of lecturing. I wrote a book, Ethical Marketing and the New Consumer, and formed a lot of the templates of how people started to think. And that was something that really took me down a road of also looking at it from much more of a consumer point of view. And what I came across while pushing the ethics was I started reading a lot more about the power of crowds. And so I've always been fascinated by psychology. My brother did psychology, and I read pretty much every book he did and sort of co-studied psychology. And this idea that we work in communities suddenly occurred to me that, well, we are more influenced by our communities than we are by individuality. Yeah, we like to think we're individuals, but largely, you see, especially among kids and teenagers and students, you know, it's all about what's the crowd doing. And I started linking this up with ethics as well and purpose and all that. So it all came together. And we had spun off from Creative Orchestra a number of subdivisions. We'd done one called Komobi 2, which is all about technologies and RFIDs and stuff. And it'd been okay for a while, but it hadn't really been long-term success, so we closed it down. So we're always launching new subdivisions. And I met two guys who were very much into this idea of community engagement. And I said, well, this marries well without my belief about purpose and ethics. And what we did is we then got together and then launched it as a separate company. And what we do is we work with things like retail brands, helping them connect with communities. So that's a very strong ethics. You know, there's a lot of talk about things called ESGs, environmental, social, governance, which is about how companies report to shareholders about what they're doing about their environmental policies, their social interactions, that includes things like slavery and looking after their staff, and then governance as well, which is how they run the business. And for me, it was very key that we could link that all together with what is the big term of moment of purpose. Everyone's got a purpose and their ethics. And so Connect2 is very much about connecting. And what we found we're doing is we are connecting brands with communities. We're helping actually connect brands internally between marketing and corporate comms and CSR. So one side, you have corporate comms and CSR who are accountable to the shareholders and stakeholders. So they're interested in, you know, how do the shareholders feel? What do they think? And they sit alongside the CEO. Way over to the left here, we have this marketing department where the CMO is, who often doesn't get treated very well, not often on the board. As one said to me, we're treated like the kids with the coloring pencils in the corner. But they're often having to translate that mission, that ethical belief into something that consumers can actually, you know, buy effectively. And they're not actually connecting very well. So we've started helping people connect on that. And what we've also said is that brands are not connecting very well with their customers. So for example, there's a big retail brand that's been pitching to, and they're going down this role of net zero. But their customers don't care about net zero. They care about plastic. They care about the fact that their products are not slavery driven. They care about the fact that the animals are well looked after. You know, they also want to know the staff are well paid. So, and they also want to know what they're contributing to the local community. So meanwhile, the big brand is going down this route of net zero, and they have what we call values disconnect. And so what we're doing is we're connecting brands with consumers in a way that starts with the consumer first. And it sounds basically obvious and simple, but you'd be shocked at how many people are not doing it. You know, so connecting things up has almost become our theme, and we're doing a lot of focus on that moment in just sort of making connections. And it's, you know, if you make connections with people, life gets better. You link to this. We're only six people apart from the next person. You see that on LinkedIn, isn't it? You click on someone, suddenly you're connected to 50 people. So we are very much about building connections. And in a way, what started as a very marketing proposition has become a bit of a philosophy for us about this whole thing about connecting. And we just feel that also, the more people connect, the more it kind of takes you to an ethical place. You know, so I'm a great believer that, you know, brands have a great opportunity to become responsible and ethical, and that too many of them are still faking it, basically. But we're starting to see the fact that the consumers are spotting the fakes.
Yeah, amazing. So with that said, I mean, how have you been able to connect brands and community during such a disconnected time? I mean, what's some of you guys' sort of insights on that?
Well, interesting. I mean, we're one of our clients. We, for example, what we did is we go into areas. The first thing we do is we profile the area called community mapping. So we go into an area where they've got one or two stores and we map the area, because every area is different. And we look at their communities and we say, okay, what can they offer the community and what does the community want? And we try and find that commonality that connects them. Because what a lot of brands do, they make a big mistake. They go in to say, okay, we've just opened a store in somewhere, place, and we're just going to do that. Well, maybe the community doesn't want you to do that. Maybe you haven't asked the community and they impose. And the big mistake marketing makes is to think you can sell things to people. And I say radically, stop selling, encourage people to buy. And the difference between that mentality is that if I buy something, it's usually because their values align with my values. Their offer aligns with my needs. Their solution offers with my problem. You know, so that's when I buy stuff. When you sell me, you're selling me something I don't really want. So when we talked to this one supermarket about net zero, they were trying to sell it to their consumers, but their consumers don't want to buy it. But there's something that they do want to buy and they're not offering it. So we do the same in the community. We look at what does the community want. And wherever you go, the communities are very different. I mean, it's probably the same in America. You know, you might go to one area and it's middle class, one area is very working class, one area is very high on these values, one area is very low on these values. You know, if you've got an area that's full of big car manufacturers, it's going to be a very different area than somewhere that's, you know, maybe a fishing village. So you have to look at the area and do this profiling. We do this mapping and we go and talk to people in the community and we say, well, what could our client do for you? You know, and that's really eye-opening because consumers aren't used to brands asking them first. They're used to being told by brands because brands tend to bully people or just impose their thinking. And I found that really amazing because when you talk to people, I just love talking to people, they come back with so much that you think, oh, yes. And it almost is easy. You know, well, they just want you to do this. Great, let's do it. You know, and we've done some really interesting, but we did a massive mural in one part of London, which is 60 meters long and 3 meters high. And it was on a major housing estate. And we worked with this local charity and some other local groups. And this had six big tower blocks. And it was known as one of the most dangerous estates in England, which it isn't, by the way. But yeah, the press liked to do it. And this wall had been graffitied over. And what the community said was that that wall is intimidating. Every day we walk in and out to the high street, we see that wall and it makes us feel threatened. Can you do something about it? So we got all the kids involved in the local schools and we did a history of the area in a load of different sessions. The kids all drew it up and then we got artists in who then took that and turned it into nice looking art. And then the kids all came and painted it. So they sketched it out. So we had this 30 meter wall and this local charity had been fantastic in organizing a lot of this. And within a month, the wall had been transferred into this amazing collage of the history and the storytelling of the area. And it had been done by the community. And it was, and what someone said in the interview afterwards said, you know, we've taken back ownership. We've empowered ourselves. It's now a community wall. And instantly everyone said it has changed the mental attitude massively. And that is where the brand had gone in there and helped make a difference. And of course, what they feel about the brand is something you could never have got from a normal marketing, you know. And that's something that I find, it's like you're almost discovering a whole new area of marketing on a different platform that, you know, you see a lot of marketing is stuck in an old school mentality of, you know, right proposition, flog stuff to people, spend as much money on media as you can in the hope it might work. And yet this thing costs a fraction of any media spend.
So what has been the reaction of fellow dyslexic to your journey?
Positive, to be honest. It's interesting. I got a guy who used to work for me and he didn't know he was dyslexic at the time. And I just thought he was chaotic. And he was actually in the wrong job. He was in account handling and he left and he worked for us about 6 months and he was a nice guy. And I always admired him for his thinking, but he was in the wrong job. And because he was in the wrong job, we didn't really see him in the right way. And he didn't know he was dyslexic. And it was only over the next 10 years, he discovered he was dyslexic when he tried to do accountancy. So the worst possible thing you could do is try and become an accountant when you're dyslexic. And he's amazing, actually, because he's done some incredible things. And yeah, we chat a lot now. And he said it was amazing. When he said he realized he was dyslexic, he was almost on the phone to me straight away going, Chris, I'm dyslexic. You know, I need someone to talk to. You know? And I find I have a lot of conversations with people who, you know, talk about, you know, their issues, but their revelations and the challenges. And what I do find is people ring me up and say, look, you know, I'm working for this big corporate ad agency and they just don't get it. And, you know, how can I do this? And, you know, we were having the conversation with someone the other day and we were explaining that, you know, we are dimensional thinkers. They are not. And I'm going to put a little bit of a story in here. There's a guy, he's a Victorian guy. He wrote a book called Flatlands. And Flatlands was a book about dimensionalization. It's about how can you think in different dimensions. And he was actually a priest as well as a mathematician. And the story is quite simple. It's a bit like Who Moved My Cheese? But the story goes that, you know, you have a creature that lives in a one-dimensional space. So basically a dot. Then you have someone that lives in a two-dimensional space. And this dot can move all the way around like on a tray, but can't go up and down. And then you have this one that lives in a three-dimensional world, so it can go up and down and sideways. And then he multiplies that and said, what if you then have an next dimension? We can only really understand a certain capacity of actually four dimensions, which is three dimensions with time. Our brains aren't wired to go beyond that. He said, but if you take the three-dimensional world, the two-dimensional world cannot understand the three dimensions because it doesn't understand this idea of up and down. And I use that a lot in my lectures and workshops to talk about, you know, thinking and, you know, marrying it with psychometrics. And what you find is, of course, that as dyslexic thinkers, we are three-dimensional thinkers. And people have used that term to say we're dimensional thinkers. We tend to, and you'll relate to this, you know, it's a bit like that thing you get in, I think it's like Matrix or something, where you've got this sphere of things and you're pulling them down and linking them all up. And, you know, suddenly it's like, I can make the connection, droom. And single-dimensional people don't see that. They have to make a linear line to it. And so they can't understand our world, but we can understand their world. So when I talked to dyslexia, I said, you've got to kind of put your mindset. So what you need to do is to sell your thinking on their level, not expect them to come to your level. And that tends to be a bit of a kind of swallow hard and, you know, bite the bullet, but sometimes it's the only way to do it. So, yeah, you have to put it in a context so they understand. And I do talk to a lot of people frustrated. And it's one of the interesting studies was that why there are so many entrepreneurs who are dyslexic. Question could be asked is why do so many dyslexics leave companies to become entrepreneurs, which is actually the true answer. That's because at the beginning, if you look at the three stages of most companies, you have the entry level, then you have middle management, then you have senior management. What happens is that the entry level is more fluid and there's more flux. But when you get to the middle level, which is middle management, it's very, very boxy, linear, process driven. And who flourishes in that tends to be the more neurotypical, neurolinear. What happens is dyslexic people and autistic people just go, I can't do this. I'm going to quit. By which time they've got 3 or 4 years belt experience. They go off and they start their own businesses. What the big brain drain is that when it gets to senior management, it's why so many companies are just going down the pan and failing to be agile and modernistic and thinking differently is because they haven't got anybody in it who does that. They've just promoted loads of neurolinear people to the top. So then these other guys go off and start competitive companies. Far more dynamic, far more agile, far more creative, and wipe them out. And that's evolution for you.
Yeah, well, it makes total sense. I love the analogy of the 3+ time, which is so how we really see it. You know, I find time also negotiable, you know, because if I think so fast and if I can slow down, I can compact a lot more insight in a very short amount of sort of accountable time, which is tend to be linear. What have you learned about yourself through all of your dyslexia and all of these experiences? What's some of the insights that you take for yourself?
I think in a way it's given me a lot of strength. I think it is. And although, I mean, I've never been depressed in my life, and that's probably not dyslexic. It's just I'm lucky that I don't ever get depressed. I'm always enthusiastic. I've always got another idea. I'm always trying to do too many things. I wish there was more than one of me. In fact, I was born an identical twin, but my identical twin died at birth. So, you know, there could have been two of us. That'd be a shock horror. We certainly could have then divided more. I have learned about strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, I'm now learning more and more. Don't do the things you're not very good at. But the problem is when you start companies, for example, we all know that we have to wear 6 or 7 hats. And sometimes that hat has to be one you don't want to wear. So I've had to learn how to also do things occasionally I don't want to do. You know, I don't like filling in tax forms. I did contact the tax office 1 year and said, I'm dyslexic. I don't think your tax forms are neurodiverse friendly, you know, and therefore you shouldn't fine me for being late. And I got off the fine, you know, so It worked. You see, there's strategy in play, isn't there? But I've learned that, you know, the things is do the things you're good at. Don't try and do the things you're not very good at. And always think of the fact that you work better in a team. And I say this to a lot of people. Say, yeah, there's nothing worse than someone trying to do something solo and failing because they tried to do too many things and they tried to do things they did badly when they could have been focusing more on the things they were doing good. So I tend to find, I saw my father as when he got older, he became very solo in the way he did things. And I said to him, you really should work with other people because it makes a big difference. And what I like about like that diversity lab is there's an opportunity to work with other people. and also, you know, balance. But also, I think it's very important to find people. Like when I organize festivals as well on a sideline as part of my community stuff. And, you know, I'm not very good at certain things. So I find people who are good at that kind of stuff, who's very good at basic logistics, you know, who can do the finance. And I think I've learned that the thing about do what you're good at, don't try and do the things you're bad at, but sometimes you might have to. So work out how you're going to do it. But basically, focus your time on what you're good at. Don't waste your time doing what you can't do. And I think that's made a big difference in my life. However, I do have a major problem that I'm always trying to do too many things at once. You know, I've still not learned how to really follow my, I write a list every day. You know the one they say, write the list, you know, then put it into, is it important? Is it urgent? And all that. And I do that. Right. And by the end of the day, I still done hardly anything on the list, but I've done 20 other things.
That's right. Well, you know, as they go, they say, if you want to get something done, give it to a busy person. And I find dyslexics tend to be very busy in both mind as well as ideas and effort. So the days that I have very little to do, they actually stress me out. I get overwhelmed with nothing, you know. So those don't happen that often. But where can people go who wants to learn more about you and your up and coming project? Where can they go to find out more about what you guys are doing?
I would say, I mean, usually LinkedIn is one of our best things. I mean, I'm on LinkedIn, so you can look me up as Dr. Chris Arnold. And I said, that's quite a privilege because I teach at Bournemouth University occasionally. I have a great feeling of giving back. For me, it's very important. It's an emotional thing that, you know, to give back. I've always liked working in schools and students. And when we started Creative Orchestra, we actually had this concept of taking young people up and incubating them, which is what we've always done. And about 200 comes through the place. But, you know, so in fact, as a consequence of doing the work with Bournemouth, I was given a doctorate, which is great because it's like not many of us get doctors. And although in some ways you could say, well, you know, my brother gets very upset because he said he does all this reading up to try and get these masters. And I got just given one. I said, yes, but I was given it for the fact that I'd done an immense amount of work in developing the concept of ethical marketing and written books on it and many articles. So I kind of earned it in a different way. And it does have kudos, which is quite good. But if you go onto LinkedIn, you find there's a lot of articles. Although, interesting enough, I've had to challenge myself in writing. And this is interesting, you know, I'm just going to divert a bit to when I wrote the book, Ethical Marketing, the New Consumer. I've been doing a lot of lecturing because I find PowerPoints quite easy to put together because you can do them. I'll tell you the secret of why I came across and how I wrote the book. So I got approached by a publisher who said, look, we've got one book on ethical marketing, but it's a bit too highbrow and intellectual and nobody understands it. And so we've not got a lot of positive feedback on it, but it's good for those who understand it. But we want something more popular. So we've been reading some of your articles and stuff, and they're really quite light and they're very chatty. And that's because I write as I speak. And I can only write by literally starting and finishing. I can't go back and re-edit it and all that kind of stuff. I just can't do that. But I can have all the ideas in my head, just sit there and go, okay, I'll write a 1,000-word blog. And then spell checker, someone to check the grammar, sort out all the bits that we dyslexics are not good at. So they said to me, would you like to write this book? I said, yeah, great. Because of course, anybody asks you to write a book, you're instantly flattered and like, what an achievement, because my brothers haven't written one. So I said, agreed to write this book. And I had certainly had most of the material in my head. And I said, how long do you want? He said, oh, 60,000 words. I said, okay, that's quite a lot, but you know, maybe. And I said, look, can I firstly write it in a non-linear way? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I don't want to write a book where you have to read it in structured order. I want to be able to write it in little sections. And yeah, like sound bites. He said, oh, we don't do books like that. But okay, we'll try that out. That sounds okay. Anyways, I went off and 6 months had passed and I'd written 20,000 words and it was terrible. It was a disaster. And I got him out. I was getting to a crisis point going, what am I going to do? How am I going to solve this? You know, I just can't write 60,000 words. I can't put all those ideas in my head all at once and try and do this. This is not working. I met another guy who's dyslexic and he said, have you tried chunking? I said, what's chunking? He said, well, firstly, how long can you hyperfocus for? I said, well, I can hyperfocus for about 3 hours. I said, great. He said, chunking is breaking everything down into small bits. Now, you've got to break down bits that you can do in a hyperfocus session. So, well, how much could you write in 3 hours? I said, well, if I've got the material in my head and I prep myself and I'm just focusing on one thing, I could write 3,000 words. He said, right, so break your book down. So we started with the chapters, then broken into subchapters. And then I worked with this girl, Sarah, who had been a secretary, but was an editor as well. And she came in, she helped me compile all this information we'd gathered. We got little sheets with data on it and facts and articles. And we'd highlighted. So we had a lot of solid material to put in it. So it wasn't just someone waffling for 60,000 words. It was a lot of really good facts. And we put them into folders. And we had a folder for each one of these sections. So each of these hyper-focused sections, I had a folder. So I went to Spain because I had to cut off distraction because as we all know who's ADHD, any distraction means you get lost. And so I went to Spain. We had a house over there before Alex was born. And my wife went out in the morning 8:30 and didn't come back till 1:30. And I'd sit down, have some breakfast, have a shower, sit down on the desk and go, right, I'm going to write. And I have to say, I looked at the computer the other day that I was writing on thinking, how do I even use that now compared to the modern ones? And I sat there and I wrote solidly for that period. And I didn't even get up once from the chair each morning. I just, once I was in there, I just wrote for 3-4 hours. And I'd spend 20 minutes reading all the notes, getting in my head, and then occasionally checking them through. Then I would send the copy to Sarah in London, and she would then edit it through, check it for spelling, check it for grammar, check it for repetition and things like that, and any questions. Good thing was, almost every time I sent it, she said, nope, that's fine. You know, I've done all the corrections. It's all good. And what surprised me, that in the space of 10 days, how many words do you think I'd written? Have a guess.
10 days. You said that it's 3 hours a day, right?
Yeah, I was saying 3 to 4 hours a day.
Yeah. 30 hours. Yeah, you probably did about, you probably got faster and faster at it, because I can kind of imagine how you did. So you probably overwrote. You probably got, you know, to 80,000 words or something.
I wrote 100,000. Even I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
We did the spell check. When we did the word check on it, it was like, Jesus. Yeah. But it proved the power of hyperfocusing. And now I'm teaching people to do that, to say, like, hey, this is how you chunk down the hyperfocus and how you do these things. Well, that's a simplistic version of it, by the way.
Well, so exciting. I can't wait to pick up a book and get a good read out of it and keep flipping my dyslexia all around.
Yeah, as soon as it comes out, we'll be doing a second podcast.
Oh, I look forward to that, Chris. Well, I can't thank you enough for this wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your amazing thinking and your time. And for those of you who are interested to learn more about Chris's work with Connect2, you can visit connect2-uk.com. You can also find Diversity Lab on the web at diversitylab.com. That's diversity with a Y. I'm Gil Gershoni, and you've been listening to Dyslexic Design Thinking.
If you enjoyed our conversation today, be sure to subscribe to this series wherever you get your podcasts and follow along on Instagram at Dyslexic Design Thinking. You can also drop us a line at dyslexia@gershoni.com. to receive our monthly newsletter and learn about our upcoming programming. Dyslexic Design Thinking is produced by Gershoni Creative. Until next time, be well.